Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Yes, it's Sunday, and we are burning down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Welcome. A frosty, frosty day here in Brooklyn. This afternoon, our guest is Amanda Coulson Hurley, who is a writer with good bona fides, unlike our guest last week. You should check that out. That was a lot of fun. Amanda, join us. Hello, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. I'm here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
I'm so glad that you could join us. Amanda is a writer, and she has... I'm going to read from your blog bio here, so you don't have to pat yourself on the back. She's been a writer specializing in the built environment, and these days, she's a director of communications for the Institute for Market Transformation, and we'll talk about that anon. She was an editor at Architect Magazine, which all of you architectos know well, one of my favorite magazines. And she's covered topics including our favorite, sustainability, international practice, architectural education, impact of the recession. Ugh, the recession on American architecture, integrated design, and BIM. And has worked on an annual survey of architectural professionals, which I hope we have some time to talk about that. That's one of... that's a topic that comes up all the time in the studio. And previously was an editor at Preservation Magazine of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Yay.
Yay.
We like historic preservation a lot here. And she's a freelancer writing for Baltimore's Urbanite. I don't know that. We can talk about that later. The Wilson Quarterly and the Times. Is that the London Times Literary Supplement?
Yeah, that was very early in my career. Actually, the TLS was the first publication that I ever wrote for.
Splendid.
I was still in graduate school, so I contributed several book reviews back in, this is dating me, but back in about 2000 or 2001.
Wow. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. So you're a good person to talk to because, as we frequently note, it seems... especially these days, but perhaps every 30 or 40 years, that architecture comes to a crossroads. Jack, I'm feeling a break coming up very soon. So before we dive into these topics, let's have a little musical interlude. Thank you.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
We're back with Amanda Colson Hurley, a writer whose work is all around. Hi. Are you still there?
I'm still here. I think you had wanted to dive into some discussion about architecture being at a crossroads.
That was just to lead into all these other things that you've written about recently.
Right.
We can talk about integrated. Well, tell us about your background. How did you decide to start writing about design? I mean, I note that you have 2 degrees from British universities and pretty sniffy, wonderful. I mean, St. Andrews and Bristol. I don't know Bristol, but an English PhD strikes me as something rather posh and wonderful.
I should point out that the English PhD program is considerably shorter than the American version. So,
yay!
I was able to enter it right after my undergraduate degree was finished, and it took about 3 years plus change. So, that's obviously a lot shorter than the kind of 7-year path that I think is pretty typical for the humanities in the U.S. So I don't know, if I had been in an American PhD program, I'm not sure I would have stuck it out the whole way. I'm not sure if it's posh. I mean, remember all the universities are state funded over there, which is pretty nice, and tuition was a lot lower.
Yeah.
As well. Although, you know, they really raised the tuition rates over there because they're in the same economic mess that we are. So I'm not sure the difference is quite as big as it was back then. I mean, back then it was really the cost was a lot less.
One of my
degree in England, yeah.
Yeah, one of my daughters who eventually went to University of Chicago was also accepted to Durham. Durham would have cost $24,000 US, and Chicago at that time. Then that included room, board, beer money, books, travel to London, and Chicago cost about $50,000 at that time. So,
right,
that's pretty.
So twice as much.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you start out with an international baccalaureate?
No, I didn't. I just, I did, you know, the usual high school curriculum in the U.S. With some AP classes. And I think I had heard about St. Andrews and just applied sort of on a whim. But I was, at that time, you know, I really wanted to be a classics major. I was a real Latin nerd in high school. And obviously the British universities have a long and great tradition of classical scholarship, so that seemed like a natural place to go. And so I was an English and Latin major in college, and then I wrote my PhD dissertation on really on elements of the classical tradition in English poetry, which is a natural way to prepare for a career in architectural journalism.
Oh yeah,
decided to be someone who wrote about architecture and buildings and cities. That sort of happened.
No, I don't see how you get from Blake to, maybe from Blake to Ruskin to Wright. I don't know.
Ruskin might have been a natural kind of pathway. But no, it happened more that, you know, my first job when I moved back to the States from the UK was my first, you know, real paid job was at a small archaeology magazine. And that was, it was a group of archaeology magazines, and two of their magazines were really about the ancient Near East and ancient Greece, Rome, and Egypt. So, you know, they were basically taking articles by academics and handing them to the editors and saying, all right, now translate this into kind of normal person speak. So we were really editing academic papers and academic writing for a more general audience of enthusiasts and selecting photos of appropriate artifacts and archaeological sites to illustrate them. So they were obviously, I was interested in journalism and in moving into journalism, and the magazines were appreciative of someone who, you know, was pretty well grounded in the history of that period. So that was sort of my transition point, I guess.
Wait, and from then, archaeology, yeah, you got into architecture?
Well, you know, obviously that's pretty different. Writing about
things.
The architecture of 2,000 and sometimes 3,000 years ago, and writing about Morphosis or something. But you know, I guess that was the first job where I was having to look at site plans and at objects and trying to make select art that would really complement and work well with the text of the story.
Right. That's making perfect sense. And before you came on, earlier this week, we spoke briefly about journalism becoming implied third-party advocacy. And so if you're writing about archaeology, I mean, it's not like you're pimping for Imhotep.
Right. Well, yeah, although, you know, even in a way, this might surprise you, that was probably the job that I've had, and I've had a few editorial jobs now, but that was probably the one where the politics were the most contentious, and that's because one of the magazines was concerned the archaeology of the biblical period in the ancient Near East, in Israel and Palestine, in Egypt, and that is a field where if any new piece of evidence comes to light that might either change or confirm certain historical narratives that and how they support or don't support a kind of traditional reading of biblical history, it explodes into a huge kind of political and religious fight. So that was a real eye opener into how what might seem a very esoteric piece of research can have, huge repercussions, for people who take this stuff very seriously.
But I can scarcely believe that that someone would discover a cave tomb under Golgotha Hill with a stone rolled in front of it with a skeleton of a carpenter. I mean, so...
Well, one of the lauded discoveries when I was at this group of magazines was an ossuary or bone box, mm-hmm, that apparently was inscribed with the inscription included the words, I think, the brother of Jesus.
Oh yes, I read all about that. Yes, yes, yes.
But you know, there was a lot of at the time there were a lot of questions about the antiquities dealer in whose possession this was found, and I'm never even sure how it got resolved, because I think that was the point when I went to Preservation Magazine, and that's really where I started writing about buildings in the non-ancient sense of the word.
Right, just old, but not of antiquity.
Right, right. H.H. Yeah. Richardson, not King Solomon. So.
No, I read all about that bone box, and I read about it in Archaeology magazine. Did you write for them?
No, this was actually, archaeology was probably our big competitor in that space. It was one called Archaeology Odyssey. It was one of the magazines, and the other one was Biblical Archaeology Review.
I would never have subscribed to that, but that's out of my orbit. Well, so that's cool. So you understand my fascination with what gets covered in current architectural journalism these days. Because, for example, to take one of my bête noire topics, if no one wrote about the stuff that Zaha Hadid does, then then she would just go away. Her stuff gets covered with photographs and very little, there is some, but very little discussion, at least in American architectural press, about whether these are good buildings, how people perceive them, do they like them, does it affect the spirit? It's all about the pictures.
Right, and I think that that's a really legitimate concern about the kind of composition of architectural journalism today. And, you know, before, earlier today, actually, I tuned in to one of your past shows, the one with Duo Dickinson.
There have been several.
I thought it was a very interesting hearing what he had to say, especially about, you know, the magazine that I, until pretty recently, worked for and was the executive editor of. And that was a really lively discussion. And
which
I don't know, maybe
that?
For listeners, you would probably do a better job summarizing his arguments than I would.
Well, Duo believes that what gets covered is purely a matter of pictorial representation, and I characterized it as sofa art, to the exclusion of coverage of people trying to make... to affect the spirit through ordinary works that aspire to rise to a level of architecture, but rather architectural press is runway fashion oriented.
Well, I think there's something to that. I'm going to. The first part of my response to that argument, and I think. One reason I brought it up is I know that he's far from alone in voicing this complaint and trying to call attention to this problem.
Oh, I'm sure that he's not. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I would respond by saying that I do think that this criticism, while it has a lot of validity, can be overstated in that if you... thinking about my old magazine, Architect, and... thinking about, although I don't know it as intimately, architectural record, you know, if you actually break down the pages and if you, you know, try to, you know, look at the proportion or put them into a pie chart, the actual pages just with, you know, splashy photos of buildings and where text is maybe a kind of secondary element is not even half, I don't think, of the page count. I mean, by the time that I left Architect, I think that was maybe 40% of the magazine. So there's a lot of the magazine that is devoted to, you know, a lot to articles where the photography of the buildings is not the kind of primary element.
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe because people flip to the back or because those photos are, you know, editors try to do right by the beautiful photos and give them good treatment and not run them small and try not to be parsimonious with them. But they do jump out at you. But I think there is a lot of great coverage. I mean, we had a really robust, you know, the magazine still has a really robust front of book section with profiles of entrepreneurs, with really pretty technical discussions about interesting details that are not always beautiful. They're just, you know, structurally really interesting.
I was going to say that, yes, Architect magazine is one of the few publications other than maybe Detail, the German magazine, with parallel English translations.
Yeah, Detail's a great magazine too. But
yeah, that actually has technical details. Right.
Yeah, I
agree.
And even the you know, kind of more photography rich you know, building articles about project by Zaha Hadid, but you know, also by, you know, El Dorado Architects, a Kansas City firm, or by some, you know, sometimes of really great healthcare design project. You know, those articles actually have a lot more, I'd say, technical and kind of project information than some other publications. And then you might expect, there's often an interview with not just the architect, but with, you know, with the client. There's a lot of project information, and sometimes, again, a detail is drawn into it, you know, about anything from, you know, the daylighting and the energy modeling to, I don't know, to the, you know, site plan. So, well, I mean, there are always site plans, but, you know, if there's something really unique about it. So
I'd say the
coverage is a little bit more, you know, fleshed out than you might see from a quick page through of the magazine.
I don't think that Duo intended to. I'm not going to speak for him, but I've spoken with him a lot, and he's a great friend. I don't think he was singling out your Hanley Wood publication specifically. I think mostly he was going after the big fish, you know, the architectural record, McGraw-Hill world.
Right, and I think...
Which is very, which is very corporate.
I think they would probably,
you know?
Say, you know, I don't know, I think, you know, Charles Lynn would probably say something similar. I don't want to speak for Charles, but he actually posted a really interesting note on AIA message boards recently about what it is that, you know, that's going through the heads of architectural editors and kind of what their decision-making process is like and the various factors that they kind of have to weigh up and consider. You know, I think that to address why and, you know, in terms of how Duo's point is legitimate, and it really is, I think there are two things driving that. And I think the first is resources, really. You know, the magazine world is not is not one where there's a lot of money sloshing around for, oh, we heard there's a really interesting panel going on about, you know, the future of architectural education. Let's or it's a conference. Let's send somebody, you know, out of town to sit in on it and, you know, cover it for a day or two.
No, and that doesn't even get covered if there are local people who are willing to write for, say, Architects newspaper. Because it just doesn't happen. And so is lacuna the right word? Of real-time commenting on what people are really talking about. And
I think you know, the staffs of the, you know, major architecture and news and you know, magazine outlets are, you know, are not big. And it's funny, I was looking at an early 90s issue of Progressive Architecture, you know, earlier this year, and I couldn't help but notice, you know, how much bigger the staff was than, you know, than I think would be normal at, you know, it would be standard at any kind of architecture publication these days. You know, there are various industry-wide changes across the news industry that have resulted in that. But, you know, people have to be pretty strategic about what they cover. And, you know, in terms of the kind of photo bias or, you know, the kind of what some people might call building porn. A lot of people call it that. I went through at the magazine a couple of rounds of focus groups, and I know that, you know, I'm pretty sure our, you know, peer publications went through the same thing. And really, when you ask a bunch of architects, you know, which of these things do you really most want to see in a magazine? Do you want to see business news? Do you want, profiles of admirable, interesting people in the profession? Do you want CEUs? Do you want photo-rich articles about buildings? Well, guess what they all really want? People answer that they really want the photo-rich stories about buildings.
I've done focus groups. It all depends on who you have in the focus groups. Were they self-electing? How did you find them? It's like any survey. You can skew it quite significantly.
I wasn't directly involved in the selection and administration of that focus group exercise or either of them. But I believe that probably a third party, group was brought in.
Okay, I'll take your disclaimer from the editorial point of view that's what the people told you. Let's move on in the next section. Hold on to the changes that you see, I see, we all see in terms of a focus away from what it looks like to how we put it together, and the story there, I think, mm-hmm. is the change from the traditional way of doing drawings, and then someone builds it to BIM, building information management and integrated product delivery. Jack, could we have a couple minutes of Bowie, please?
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. You wanna be a richer man. Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. There's gonna have to be a different man. Now may change me.
Changes in the profession. Building information management is a 3D but with intelligent objects. That means in cyberspace, almost like if you're a fan of The Matrix. It's a whole virtual reality world. And some architects imagine that it will allow us to become or to regain mastery of the building process from design through directing how things fit together. Now it's your turn.
Now it's my turn, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I reported on BIM. I'm trying to think of the last article I wrote about it. I wrote a couple of interesting articles about a couple of years ago. I think the challenge with BIM was that there were a couple of challenges. The first one was that there was a lot of talk about it being a revolution, but people were kind of looking around you know, from left to right, saying, "All right, well, you know, this is a revolution. Why is nobody kind of storming the gates here?" So there was a lot of talk about it, and I think maybe people were feeling like that hadn't translated into anything tangible for them yet that they were seeing.
Well, part of it was BIM was just coming into awareness as the Second Great Depression was developing.
I'm sure that was a factor, you know, that probably a lot more firms would have, you know, gotten on to the software and started trying to train up their people if they hadn't been, you know, so hard hit by what happened in 2008.
Oh, yeah. Know about
so,
that, for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. I didn't really thought about that as a direct factor, but I'm sure it was.
Well, you know,
and then I think there was also a time when, you know, there was a big question, and I think this is probably still the case where, you know, a lot of larger firms had moved into, you know, were working entirely in Revit, and but for small firms, there was, and I think there still is, maybe a question of, you know, is this really worth us making this huge shift over to?
And
a school for the big guys.
Yeah. And even right now, there is this peer pressure. I'm in a 60-person firm, and we are doing projects in Revit, and it is a it is a huge time suck. We could have done these projects much more quickly with paper and pencil and tracings and overlaying tracings and working out coordination in the third dimension. For those of you who are non-architects, and we have a significant number of people who listen just because they want to hear what design people talk to each other about, Revit is the Autodesk, the people who make AutoCAD. And if you think of computer-aided drafting, you probably think it is AutoCAD. There are many other computer-aided drafting programs that are out there. And Revit is the Autodesk BIM program that is being used predominantly. But then Bentley has a BIM program, and there are other 3D-rich CAD programs, computer-aided drafting, that are out there that do almost everything that Revit does, and perhaps in some ways better. And certainly, I myself was an early adopter of CAD, and I did, when I had my own practice, a lot of my work in 3D. Matter of fact, almost all of it. But it wasn't smart 3D. It was just, if things were in the same space, You could detect that by looking at the 3D views. Now, Revit doesn't tell you when there are clashes. You have to take your Revit model and run it through Navisworks, which is a different program. So it's very expensive for a firm to have all this software floating around. And so,
yeah, I actually had no idea it couldn't detect clashes.
Yeah,
I assumed that one of the main advantages was that it could.
No, it just gives you the raw data, and you got to run it through something else to find the clashes. And sometimes the clashes are intentional. So then you have to have actual humans telling you whether that's okay or not. So it's not robotized architecture, and it ain't there. Anyway, so firms are saying, yes, everyone expects us to do Revit, and so we're doing Revit, and it takes a lot of time. And yes, there are some advantages, because a wall is a smart wall, and if you put in a window, it automatically opens it up, and if you change all that type of window, it fixes it so that when you take an orthographic, which for the lay people out there means the left, right, up, and down views of a building, everything is all tightened up, and the window's not just floating in space. Great. Okay. How often do we do that? Well, often enough, so there's some advantages there. However, getting this stuff into Revit is not as easy as just drawing a sketch. And people have to be trained because it has a totally different interface. And everybody who uses a computer knows about interfaces. It's like the difference between using Firefox versus Safari. You know, there's slight differences. And so it's not a panacea. It doesn't make everything better. And so far, it's requiring architects to do a lot of work that's useful to other people in the construction project. That we're presently, as architects, are not being compensated for. So we're creating we're creating value for other people in the overall project delivery, which then gets us to integrated project delivery, or IPD, which I believe you've also looked into.
Right. Well, it's the relationship between BIM and IPD is kind of interesting because the real proponents of IPD say, don't confuse it with BIM, don't confuse it with BIM. But and it is different because BIM is the technology, and
right.
IPD is the process. But I think it's fair to say, it might be a little bit of a generalization, but I think it's pretty fair to say that IPD is really a process that arises from BIM and is not really possible, I don't think, without BIM. And because BIM gives you the real-time model, the real-time, incredibly rich model that can be shared by the different parties working on the project. So with IPD, the idea is that instead of having the construction, the design and construction progress through these, very clearly demarcated stages, as it did, as the traditional kind of project delivery goes, where, at the end of your stage, you hand it off and you're sort of done with it, that certain things that, would have happened halfway through or toward the end of a project actually happen more on the front end, and that everybody is sort of, working together and on the same page. And by everybody, I mean, the architect, the GC, I think a lot of the subs.
And the owner.
And they're all in the same room having, regular check-ins from pretty much the beginning.
Right.
And I think, the hope of a lot of architects who are early adopters and real IPD advocates is that the natural person or the person who, in that room who should take the leadership role is the architect who can kind of be the ringmaster of this process and assert some leadership that way.
As I understand IPD, it's a team effort. As I know, to do integrated project delivery, you have to create a separate legal entity in which the owner, the constructor, the architect, and the engineers are all participants. So nobody can sue anybody because all decisions are jointly made and agreed to by this corporate entity.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a lot of risk out. But at the same time, as the architects are developing a concept for, let's say, how the facade should be constructed. The constructors are pricing it. The engineers are evaluating its thermal and structural potential. And the owner is a piece of the pie saying, what's the trade-off between, is it whiz-bang beautiful and is it going to cost me a lot of money, and can I sell it because it's more thermally efficient? What's my market? And so these conversations happen collaboratively in a way that has been not so much the rule previously. But a lot of this, I don't know how much research you were able to do while you were writing in the architectural press about the received notions of practice. And a lot of the received notions of practice that we are architects have come to understand come from the AIA, and they come from reactive position to some of the colossal failures in the 1970s, where architects attempted to reduce their risk by not taking a stand, which is totally different. Now we get into archaeology or history from the point of view of the early masters of modernism, like Frank Lloyd Wright, who said, screw the engineers, falling water doesn't need all that reinforcing steel for the reinforced concrete cantilevered balconies, which ended up 50, 60 years later having 7 or 8 inches of creep, which is what happens to concrete as it sags. So Wright wasn't really right, but he wasn't wrong. But he wasn't afraid to take a point of view. The status quo, as received most, you know, currently through the AIA, is that architects shouldn't take a point of view about things that are engineering. Whereas the early architects were engineers, and in Europe, say in Spain, engineering is for colossal structures and ordinary structures up to a considerable size are the responsibility of the architect. So in IPD, everybody's in the same room, and they're all talking trade-offs, and there is cross-cultural, because the different disciplines have different cultures.
You know, I haven't reported on IPD or BIM in a while, but the last time I looked into it, I think the question of liability and what this would mean for insurance, you know, I think was still very much up in the air. I mean, I think there, the companies that insure, you know, architecture firms were really having to get up to speed with this and you know, decide how they wanted to assess it.
I don't know that they're up there yet, because it's a very new thing. I mean, it came out of the California AIA, which is kind of interesting that the Californians are more willing to get down and be friendly. Didn't come out of New York. Don't know why. We can look into that sometime in the future. But
I know there's one very pro-IPD big construction company out there that does a lot of, you know, I think, like healthcare campus or university campus projects. Of course, the name escapes me now, but I don't know, that might...
Fie on you.
Sorry?
I said fie on you. I'm sorry. I had to go English.
This is a great... No. What you said about you know, architects in the past, yeah, talking about the minimizing and then maximizing of their role and how that, you know, obviously the more of a leadership role you take, the more risk that involves and the historical kind of patterns in that. And it's funny, you know, when you were talking about back in the 70s and the trend of really the profession seeking to minimize the risk that it carried. It made me think of what engineers are doing now. I'm not sure how aware a lot of architects are that, and I think this maybe got defeated in Texas, but early last year, this was still a big problem in Texas. The engineers were seeking to essentially, you know, run the architects out of business. I mean, they were seeking to have the right to design, I can't remember what they called it, like total building engineering or something. They had some sort of vaguely Orwellian term to my ear, you know, talking about this right that they sought to basically do architectural design on, I think it would have been the vast majority of buildings in the state, and they argued that, you know, that to have an architecture, you know, stamp drawings or prepare drawings was you know, totally unnecessary, and that they could just handle it all.
That's not surprising. I don't know if you had a chance to listen in on last week's podcast.
I did not, no.
Well, we had a conversation with Mitch Joachim, who's got a PhD in architectural philosophy and a couple of master's degrees in architecture, and he proudly proclaims that he is an architect, but he doesn't have a license. Mm-hmm. And this is a very old argument that goes back at least to 1867 with Viollet-le-Duc at the French Academy, where there was the urge to separate architecture and engineering, and the engineers would make the building real, and the architects would be basically building decorators. And so it sounds like the Texas engineers have seized on that old idea, knowingly or not. I do know that Texas is a special case, and that not very recently, 10 or 15 years ago, that interior designers in Texas insisted that there should be an interior design license. Jose Hernandez, my good friend from San Antonio, clued me into this, and he's a Texas architect, and he had to get a Texas interior designer license in order to select the color of paint for the houses that he might design in Texas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in Connecticut, where I have held an architectural license, there is an interior design license also. So it's not surprising that the engineers would like, you know, in the second Great Depression, to grab more market share and say that architects are just building designers, and frankly, we can just do it all ourselves.
Yeah, who needs them? And it's the difference in requirements, you know, state to state, is to me just kind of bewildering. I mean, that there's no standardization. I think that's a real problem. One of the articles that I probably worked the longest and, you know, researched the most deeply when I was at Architect Magazine was about illegal practice of architecture.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, I did take into account the fact that in some states, you know, Mitch should probably watch where he proclaims himself an architect and how many people are listening, because I've seen pretty, you know, really seemingly innocuous cases of somebody, you know, a professor of architecture calling themselves an architect and getting had up before the licensure board, you know, of that state, which, you know, seems a little bit draconian. You know, you'd think that for somebody who, license or no license, has devoted their career to educating students of architecture or writing about architecture or so on, if, you know, if that person, if they have architectural training, can't just colloquially say, you know, as an architect, comma, dot, dot, dot. Yeah, I don't know what they're supposed to call themselves, but...
No, I suggest you know, they should call themselves an architecturist. Yes. But you know, but right. Everything, look, everything counts in large amounts. I mean, in New York State, the penalty for using, as you know, referring to oneself as an architect without having bothered to take the exam, it's in the statutes. It's a $10,000 fine, and it's a Class E felony, and felons are prohibited from being licensed. So,
right.
So you really, one should be careful about that. I do want to talk about the work that you're presently doing. Jack, could we have like 2 minutes of the next track, please? We'll be right back. Let's talk about the work that you, we're here on Burning Down the House with Amanda Colson Hurley, a writer, a thinker. I've been enjoying our conversation very much. Thank you. Are you there?
And I think you wanted to hear a little bit about what I'm doing now.
Yes, IMT.
IMT, right. Well, it's funny when I tell people where I work, they say the Institute for Market Transformation. That's quite a quite an ambitious.
Well, it sounds like you're part of
small organization.
No, it sounds like you're part of Occupy Wall Street, actually. But okay.
Right. Well, yeah, sort of in a very abstract way, maybe. IMT actually has been around since 1996. It's a small think tank in Washington, D.C. And really, its mission is to promote energy efficiency in buildings. That's really what we focus on, but not by sort of building like a demonstration project or advocating for this or that green building product to be used, but really to work on the level of policy and to kind of focus on policies that can be kind of widely adopted or replicated, around the country and possibly, or in some cases, around the world, so that if you make convince a few cities, the big markets like New York City or Chicago or San Francisco to adopt this kind of policy, it'll create a very positive ripple effect, and the idea, the hope is that you end up with really significant benefits to the sustainability of the building stock of our country and to the environment, obviously. So
yes, but Chicago and San Francisco have really different climates.
They do, and so the type of policies or strategies that we look at aren't really design specific. I have to say, in most cases, one of the big policy initiatives we're working on now is about energy benchmarking, which owners of buildings will sometimes do, in some cases, voluntarily. They say, I'm curious how much energy my building is consuming,
right.
and maybe I should start tracking that. It'll help me bring that number down. But there aren't any requirements. The policy that we've been working on a lot has been a policy in which cities mandate, they say to building owners, often owners of buildings over a certain square footage only, you have to start measuring this stuff and then sharing the data with us, with the city government. And then that allows the government to then keep a database and do comparison and track these buildings' energy usage over time as well.
Your group must have found in our mayor Bloomberg an early adopter, because that has become law in New York City.
We actually work quite closely with his office. Yeah, that is a big local law. 84 is the benchmarking law in New York City. New York has taken an incredible leadership role. I mean, with something like 2.5 billion square feet of space affected by this rule in New York. So, and it's exciting because that was ushered in, the benchmarking requirement was ushered in as part of the Greener Greater Buildings Plan, which I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Yep.
And I'm actually almost more excited about the next part, which is that, owners were given some time to comply. I think that the first batch of data they submitted, I think the first batch of data they submitted wasn't going to be made public. But I think the second batch will be. And pretty soon in New York, but also in Washington and in some of the other cities that have moved in this direction, there's the potential for, you know, to, if you're curious, to find out what, you know, all the office buildings on your block, how they compare in terms of their energy use. And I think people will probably be designing apps with this. I think that it'll be probably integrated into other websites, you know, into other GPS-enabled websites and things. So this idea that the way that we, you know, engage with the built environment, obviously technology is changing that so much. And I think the energy use of buildings is going to be part of that now, that we'll be able to know and to compare. It's really exciting.
It's exciting for me because it changes the dialogue from what a building looks like to how a building performs.
Absolutely.
And we, speaking for myself as architects, are probably the only people who can pull it all together, because there are so many different aspects of what goes into a building. And we are the grand generalists. Engineers are not trained to be generalists, but architects are. And
right, engineers are very well equipped to say that this is how this system or that system maybe can be optimized, right?
Right.
But you feel that only an architect really can look at the whole package?
Well, a really savvy owner could do that. And I've met a few of them who are very directive, but mostly the owners look to the architects to be their Indian guides, their guardians, to go through an iterative process of this is possible, this is possible, this is possible. If the architects don't do it, do you know Stanley Tigerman?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Stanley is a very outspoken, because Stanley is outspoken, proponent that if architects don't do the right thing, and this is all about doing the right thing in terms of economy and climate, then architects, if we don't do it, then no one will do it. And if nobody does it, then we've failed at our job, and then we cease to exist, and we become building decorators, apropos of your story about Texas, which people like me don't want to happen.
I'd have to agree with him there. And I also think, I'm curious how this strikes you as a practicing architect, but I think especially with these, with rising environmental awareness of, you know, exactly how imperiled we are by what we've done to the climate, and you know, and also I think with these new rules coming in cities and an understanding finally of wow, it's really our buildings that contribute, you know, to that it both contribute to our carbon emissions, but also that can be made to reduce them. This new focus on the building sector as being the problem, but also the potential solution to our level of carbon emissions, I think might really open up an entirely new area for architects. And I think that I would put out there that I think, you know, kids going to architecture school today should probably be preparing and expecting to have careers in adaptive use of existing buildings.
Absolutely.
I'd say that'll probably, I mean, I would not be surprised if in 20 years that really is like 50 or 60 or even, you know, a higher percentage of what architects do. And not just in some firms. I mean, pretty much across the board.
No, I have no. Well, if you look at the experience in Europe, most of their built environment is occupied, and you can't tear it down because people live in it or people are using it, and you just can't boot them out. And on the plus side, you know, the negative side from a developer is, I built this building, I'd like to have absolute use over the site that it's on. I'd like to build something huge, which would have lots of rent or saleability. Mm-hmm. Right. But in Europe, they have that orientation. It's only the underused sites that are being developed into something really grand and big. But from a sustainability point of view, if you can reuse something that's already been put in place, you have already gained the advantage of the industrial energy that went into producing it and the human energy.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what I think people don't understand, and which I have myself only recently understood, is that most of the built environment involves a great deal of human muscle energy.
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors hammered the nails and laid the bricks, and with the older structures, they dug the earth to place the stones for the foundation. And so there's a huge legacy of humanity that is imbued in what exists, and to tear it down actually is a great offense to our human legacy, which I admit is perhaps a little extreme to those who see a 100-year-old house that they can buy and tear down and replace with one that's three times larger. But I say to them that they are dishonoring the human legacy, which is a philosophical point of view.
It is a philosophical point of view. I mean, you, it's funny, my house is about, I don't know, 60 years old and 70 years old, and the house I lived in before was 150 years old, and somebody told me an anecdote once about a person they knew, you know, who had just bought a brand new, you know, home builder house. He said, "Oh, I'd never live in a used house." And I think, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of people have this idea that they don't want it used. They want it brand new. They want to move in with the paint still smelling fresh and brand new appliances and I personally agree with you that it's nice to live somewhere where that kind of historical effort or something and labor kind of you can feel it
and it's good for our global environment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean,
the greenest building product is one that you don't have to, tear down and throw out and replace.
Right.
The one that's right there, assuming that it's not broken or that it actually functions.
Yes. I mean, on the smallest terms, if you get your groceries in a brown paper bag, which, by the way, is made out of craft paper, which is incredibly environmentally damaging. If you look into it, it's just horrifying. But if you get that bag and you use it for something to carry around, and then you put your trash in it, and then you get rid of it, you've reduced the environmental impact threefold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
it's
all of a piece with architecture. And that's why I enjoy having these conversations here on Burning Down the House on the Heritage Radio Network, because we're all about raising the level of understanding, because everything is interconnected. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I wish and I hope that you will come back and talk with me more in a future episode about more of what you're doing with the IMT.
I'd love to.
And maybe we can even get Duo hooked in.
That would be fun. I would really enjoy that.
Amanda Colson Hurley has been our guest. This is Burning Down the House. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.